Good evening, everyone. Let me welcome you to this, our second LECE Visiting Speaker Programme of the year. Judging from the freezing hands I encountered from some of you coming in, it's a particularly unpleasant evening out there, so thank you very much indeed for coming. It's always a great pleasure welcoming people to these seminar series. It's a particular pleasure this evening to welcome Gezim, in as much as I was his PhD examiner relatively recently, and he wrote an absolutely excellent PhD on nationalist movements, the subject of his talk this evening. And so I think probably the first thing to do is offer congratulations. This really was just literally last month, so just very well done on that. I think there's a little bit of paperwork that just needs to be completed. I know that you didn't like the idea of having the doctor yet, but I know there's rules and regulations about this, but I think we can say that it's all done and dusted. By way of broader introduction, Gezim is actually now the Alexander Nash Fellow at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at University College London. His main research interests include politics, nationalism, nationalist movements and citizenship in Southeast Europe. As I mentioned, he recently completed his PhD at the University of Edinburgh. The subject of his talk tonight is political orientations and internal power struggles within the nationalist movement in Kosovo, 1968 to 2008.
Thank you, James. Thanks a lot, first of all, for inviting me to come to talk here, and thanks to everyone for coming to attend the talk. So, as James already mentioned, so my talk today is going to pretty much draw on my PhD, although here I'm going to be like brief. So my presentation today draws on my PhD, and the main topic of my PhD was looking at the inner workings of the nationalist movement in Kosovo between 1968 and 2008. So I've chosen three different periods, historical periods, to analyze the emergence of different groups and political organizations, as well as military organizations, which competed to be the flag bearers or the champions of Albanian nationalism in Yugoslavia, and also shed light on the way internal dissent and competition within the nationalist movement functions. As regards the overall approach, my approach in my PhD, so it's known that there are two main ways that looking at nationalism. So one is looking at nationalism from the perspective of politics, nationalism as a form of politics or political movement. And the other way is nationalism and national identity as a form of identity or feeling. So in my PhD, I look at the issue of nationalism more from the perspective of politics. And in this respect, I apply a lot of a number of theories that look at nationalism as a form of politics. However, probably one of the main distinct ways of looking at nationalism in my PhD is by focusing on the intra-group competition as opposed to inter-group conflict. Most of the studies that exist on the case of Kosovo focus on the issue of inter-group conflict, namely the conflict between the Kosovo Albanians and the Serbian and Yugoslav state formations during this period of time. So The definition I've used in my PhD about nationalism treats nationalist movement as an arena of political struggle for competing political and or military organizations and groups that seek to attain and exercise state power on behalf of an ethnic group or a nation. So, in other words, I treat nationalist movement as a field of differentiated and competing groups, stances and positions. So I analyze the Albanian nationalist movement by combining historical narrative, because I'm looking at a rather long historical period and sociological analysis. The first thing one has to do to understand the Kosovo Albanian nationalism is to understand the origins of the Albanian nationalism in the Balkans. So the Albanian nationalism in the Balkans is a latecomer compared to the other nationalisms that emerged in the 19th century in the region of the Balkans. But probably the two defining characteristics of the Albanian nationalism in the Balkans are that it was polycentric and secular. What do I mean by polycentric? So the Albanian nationalism lacked a clear political center. And the reason why it lacked a clear political center, it was because there was no political unit, separate administrative units. So it's known that Albanians were inhabiting four different administrative units in the Ottoman Empire. It lacked a clearly defined political elite, which had a clear nationalist agenda. So rather, there were separate groups of people with slightly different agendas, which at different points in time would cooperate in resisting the Ottoman Empire and also in trying to pursue a nationalist agenda that would lead to the creation of an independent Albanian state in the Balkans. The other characteristic is secularity. So it's especially if we compare the Albanian nationalist movement to the other movements in the Balkans, it becomes quite clear that it didn't have a religious base, although religion was often utilized by different groups in the struggle for independence, especially during the Balkan Wars in opposition to the other Balkan or armies in the region. And the reason for that is quite clear, because Albanians were belonging to three different religions, and it was clear that by omitting religion from the formal political and nationalist discourse, you would eliminate one of the elements which could be a very divisive element which would go at the detriment of the creation of a unified national movement in the region. So in 1913, Albania is recognized by great powers as an independent state with the borders it pretty much has today. However, this fact had three main consequences. So first, it turned the Albanian state into a political and cultural center for the Albanians in the region. So for the first time, Albanians in the Balkans would have a clearly defined political and cultural center in the region. It led towards bifurcation of Albanian nationalism into a state center and nation center wing. So on the one hand, there were elites mostly from Albania who were focused on creating all the state institutions necessary for a state to function. So they would give primacy to the idea of consolidating the Albanian states within the borders determined by the great powers. Whereas on the other hand, there was another group of leaders within the newly created Albanian state, which considered that the main goal and aim of the Albanians should be to include all the Albanians within one state. So they would give priority to the nation as opposed to the state. And most of the Kosovar elites, or elites which were representing Albanians, which were residing in the newly created states in the region, the Kingdom of Montenegro, the Kingdom of Serbia, as well as in Greece, they pretty much belonged to the second group of nationalists. So they thought that the Albanian elites and the state should engage into expanding its borders and include most of the Albanians within the borders of the Albanian state. And the third important development in this period was the creation of a political and nationalist narrative of an artificially and unjustly divided nation. And this narrative was quite important because it will persist throughout the existence of different Yugoslav and Serbian state formations in the 20th century, and it would be a source of mobilization for many groups and organizations that try to represent the Albanians within Yugoslavia. So here, within this, the moment of division into a state center and nation center camp, in a way, is the moment of the birth of the Albanian nationalism in in Yugoslavia. Once borders were consolidated after the end of the First World War, the Albanian elites representing Albanians outside of the state of Albania, namely in Yugoslavia, they were engaged in different forms of state opposition, and they were engaging in state subverting activities within Yugoslavia. And here we have three different groups, which were like largely defined groups, which were engaged in opposing the Yugoslav state. The first one was the political irredentist group, which was comprising the Kosovo Committee, which was created in northern Albania, and it used political means, mostly diplomacy, to garner support for the inclusion of Kosovo within the borders of Albania. So they would petition the League of Nations, they would cooperate with Bomero nationalists in undermining Yugoslav's sovereignty in Yugoslavia, but also try to gain control within the Albanian state as well. And actually, one of the leaders of the Kosovo Committee, Hasan Prishtina, was at one point minister in the Albanian government and even prime minister of one of the short-lived Albanian governments in the early 1920s. So apart from engaging to include Kosovo within Albania, these elites were also engaged in the power struggles within the Albanian state in the early 1920s. The second group was what I call the military irredentist group, which comprised mostly the outlaws or the Kachaks, who were groups of people who became famous because of their resistance towards the Ottoman Empire, and then they were actively engaged in undermining first the Serb and then the Yugoslav rule in Kosovo by pretty much putting up an armed resistance. And the third form of defending the Albanian rights was applied by the Cemiyet. This was a Turkish-Albanian political party which emerged in 1919, and it would use political means as a way of defending the interests of Albanians in Yugoslavia. However, there is an important element that distinguishes this party from the other parties. It had a rather strong religious emphasis when it comes to its activities. So at different points in time in the early 1920s, it would cooperate with different political parties, even with Pašić's party in the Yugoslav parliament, in return for some privileges for the leaders of the party, because most of the leaders of this party were landowners in Kosovo. They were rich people from the Ottoman Empire, and then they saw it important. They thought it's important for them to preserve their interests, but also to make sure that Albanians have some religious and education rights within Yugoslavia. The other period which is important and one should briefly mention is the World War II period. It's important in many ways. First of all, because of the expansion of the borders of Albania as a result of the occupation of Albania by Italy in 1939 and then later by Germany. So at that time, what is known today as the Greater Albania, so unexpanded Albania, which included most of Kosovo and Western Macedonia, became a battlefield of different groups which were competing for the control of the government but also had different ideological agendas. So the Second World War is important because for the first time the cleavages between different groups became also ideological. Before, it was mostly political. So do you favor state or nation? Whereas now, because of the partisan resistance, there was also an important ideological cleavage between the two main camps. So there were two main camps, communists on the other side and then different nationalist groups. One of them, I call them the nationalists, these were the Balikomtar, the Balists, who were like the most nationalist group, who had their supporters also outside the state of the Albania, in Kosovo and in Macedonia. And the royalists, which were a rather smaller group concentrated mostly in Albania, these were the proponents of King Sobi, which was ousted from power as a result of the Italian occupation. So in a way, what was happening in Kosovo at this period was a reflection of the main ideological battles that were going on in Albania between the two main camps, the nationalist and the communist camp. However, because of the creation of partisan units in Kosovo as well, there was another smaller group, which were the Yugoslav Albanian partisans, which were in a way part of the larger partisan groups in Yugoslavia, but also had good relations with the partisan groups in Albania. And as a result of the end of the Second World War, so we have a clear partisan victory both in Yugoslavia and in Albania. This meant that the nationalists were defeated, both in Albania and in Kosovo. And then the post-Second World War period was going to be quite different when it comes to the ideological orientation of the political groups. So the first period I understand I analyze in detail in my PhD is the period between 68 and 1988. So here we have two largely defined groups of organizations and political parties. On the one hand, we have the institutionalist autonomous group, which comprised mostly the communist Albanian communist functionaries, which at different points in time were engaged for the enhancement of Kosovo's autonomy, but also the enlargement of the scope of rights for Albanians in Yugoslavia. And on the other hand, there was a larger group of underground organizations, which I call them secessionist merger camp. Why secessionist mergers? Because most of them engaged for secession of the Albanian territories from Yugoslavia and then unification with Albania. So there was no mentioning of the idea of a separate Albanian polity within Yugoslavia. Their ultimate goal was unification with Albania, but that was to be realized after secession from Yugoslavia. And here we have some elements which would distinguish them from each other. So the first one was a sub-state camp because it was embedded within the larger Yugoslav institutional framework. The other one was a non-state actor, so these were underground illegal organizations. They were the first one to emerge was immediately after the end of the Second World War, which was a network of different groups, including remnants of different nationalist groups, including groups which were cooperating with the Germans and Italians and were also responsible for many atrocities that were committed during the Second World War against Serbian people in Kosovo. And then the other, so whereas the first camp would favor autonomy after Second World War, the second one clearly engaged in irredentist activities. When it comes to political principles, the first camp would favor territorial principle. So because of the fact that Kosovo got the status of an autonomous, first autonomous region, then a province within Yugoslavia, always the Kosovo Albanian elites, communist elites, would talk about the rights of Albanians in Yugoslavia within the borders of Kosovo. So the principle was clearly territorial, whereas for the underground organizations, the main principle was ethnic principle. So they would try to represent all the Albanians within Yugoslavia, and when they talked about Kosovo, usually they would mean Kosovo in a larger borders, including all the people, all the Albanians in today's South Serbia as well as Western Macedonia. And then also the other elements. So the first camp was state reforming. The idea was that by reforming state institutions, Albanians would get a better position within the Yugoslav state, whereas the other camp was clearly engaged in state subverting activities by cooperating, first of all, with the state of Albania through its embassies abroad. And quite a lot has been talked and written about the role of Albania. I think, and in my thesis, I argue that Albania's role was quite symbolic. It was important because Albania became a point of reference for all the Albanian nationalist groups. But after the fallout between Enver Hoxha and Tito, then things changed because of the propaganda coming from the Albanian state. So in this way, Albania's communist regime provided the language, concept, and political culture of the underground organizations. Most of these organizations were comprised people which were not that educated. They didn't know much about different theories. They were mostly quite romantic in the way they presented their case. So for them it was easier to just appropriate the discourse of the Albanian regime in Albania in their struggle to undermine the Yugoslav state. For example, most of the time they would refer to Yugoslavia as a revisionist state because this was Tirana's official policy towards Yugoslavia. However, the main characteristic of these underground organizations is that they opposed any identification with the nationalists from the Second World War and with the right-wing ideologies. So although Yugoslavia was a socialist state, and one would assume that because Yugoslavia was a socialist state, and on the other hand, because of the need to gain international support, you would think that it's quite logical that they would adopt a more right-wing ideology. Actually, they did the opposite. They would oppose the Yugoslav state system from the same ideological basis. So they would criticize Yugoslavia for being a bourgeois creation, not a proper socialist state, a state which oppresses and exploits its people, especially Albanians. And if you read many of the programs of these underground organizations, you would see that often they would even call on Serb people to revolt against the elite in Belgrade and to create a proper socialist state within Yugoslavia. As a result of the creation of Kosovo's autonomous institutions, we see a major change happening both in the way nationalist demands were put forward, but also when it comes to the transformation of demand. So gradually, the main demand that was emerging was a demand for a Kosovo Republic. And strangely enough, this demand was coming from two different positions. One was the position of young intellectuals. These were the first generation of people, of Albanians educated within the Yugoslav state system, and a part of the Kosovo communist leadership, a very small part of the Kosovo leadership. And if you read transcripts of debates in late 60s, early 70s about the constitutional changes in Yugoslavia, you would see that many people, including lawyers, prosecutors, politicians, were clearly arguing in favor of a Kosovo Republic within Yugoslavia, within the Kardel's concept of self-management of nations, of equal nations and nationalities within Yugoslavia. So the main arguments that were put forward were that Albanians had become the fourth biggest nation in Yugoslavia. They possessed an intelligentsia, which was an important element according to Lenin's concept of self-determination. So, and also they were profiting from the fact that Yugoslavia was moving towards a more decentralized state where the common denominator of Slavic origin became less important according to Kardel and other people who were responsible for reforms in Yugoslavia. And on the other hand, we have some of the smaller underground organizations who by late 70s, early 80s, starting to campaign for a Kosovo Republic within Yugoslavia. However, there was a big difference in the way they articulated the idea of a Kosovo Republic by emphasizing the ethnic principles. So, whereas the official leadership would demand a Kosovo Republic within Kosovo's administrative borders, the underground organizations demanded that all the Albanians within Yugoslavia merge together and create a separate unit, which would be an equal unit within the Yugoslav Federation, and gradually drop the demand for unification with Albania, at least formally, the way they were presenting their case. The 1981 protests, which are quite important for many events that happened not only in Kosovo but also in Yugoslavia, are also important in the context of the intra-group struggle in Kosovo. And I think it's one of the dimensions that had been neglected quite a lot in the literature, because the 1981 protests have a very, very strong intra-group dimension. So this was also, it was a clash between the Yugoslav state policy, the official state policy, and the Albanian nationalism on the one hand, but also it was a clash between Kosovo's communist elite and the underground organizations. Because since 1974, institutions, political institutions in Kosovo were Albanicized in the sense that most the main political leaders were Albanian. They were quite powerful, and pretty much they had managed to create a separate polity within the Yugoslav state system, at least in achieving independence from Serbia. So Serbia had very, very few ways of interfering in the internal affairs in Kosovo between 68 and 81. So this clash was also a clash between two different Albanian political camps within Yugoslavia. And because when people started protesting, and I'm not going to go into the whole story of protests, also they demanded that the communist leadership of Albanians steps down. And then there were other elements, such as regional elements, because historically the communist elite in Kosovo was mostly dominated by people from Jakovo, city in western Kosovo. Actually, many people in 81 would chant slogans like "down with people from Jakovo," because they felt that there was an elite, or a clique as they called it, that controlled everything within Kosovo, and many people felt that they were neglected and sidelined in the political sphere in Kosovo. However, in a larger perspective, this protest had three main effects. The first one, they polarized the Albanian society in Kosovo because of the clash between the two camps. The second one was that they led to the elimination of Kosovo's autonomous-minded leadership with Bakali at the helm. So Bakali was one of the rising stars of Kosovo politics in the late 60s, early 70s. He was the most powerful politician in the 70s. He had to resign as a result of this protests and pressures coming from Serbia and Yugoslavia. And also, most importantly, they led to the criminalization of the political demand for a Kosovo Republic. So whereas in the late 60s and early 70s, it was acceptable that within formal discussions at different party meetings, people could argue in favor of independence within the predominant ideological discourse in Yugoslavia, and they wouldn't be prosecuted for this thing. But after the 81 protests, things changed, and actually many people, thousands of people, went to prison for either mentioning the word or writing graffitis Kosovo Republic. So with the autonomous-minded political elite being marginalized, there was a reversal, because the 81 protests also opened the door or the way for Serbia to interfere again in the internal affairs in Kosovo, both the federal and the republican institutions. And they empowered, actually, or created opportunities for older communist cadres which were sidelined in the 70s, and these were people who were more anti-nationalist in their understanding of politics, and they were also they were more willing to cooperate with the Serbian and the Yugoslav elites in Yugoslavia when it comes to different issues. And this created a very particular situation in Kosovo where there was a huge gap between the political leadership and people. So people were gradually detached from the political leadership, and they felt that the political leadership which was dominating Kosovo was not representing the rights of the people in Kosovo. So this situation created and it reached its peak in 1988-89, and as a result, because also of the other events happening elsewhere in Yugoslavia, debates about democratization and about reforms in Yugoslavia, as a result of the economic crisis and other factors, to pave the way for the emergence of new elites, which would come mostly from people who were not involved in politics before. These were intellectuals from the University of Pristina and other cultural and education institutions in Kosovo. And most importantly, this the events of 88-89 led to major shift in ideological outlook and discursive character of the Kosovo movement. And finally, they increase the role of external functions of ideology and audiences. When it comes to external functions, it's briefly explaining. So, according to John Brulé, the nationalist ideology has internal and external functions. The main internal functions are the building a mass popular movement which gains international, which gains domestic support for a nationalist cause, whereas the external function of ideology is gaining internal support for the cause it promotes. So this period is known as the period of the emergence of the Kosovo Alternative, which was a network of groups and organizations which were quite different in their character, but also in terms of the demands they were putting forward. Some of them are human rights organizations, which clearly rose in opposition to the human rights violation in Kosovo. Others were called associations, and then gradually the first political parties emerged in Kosovo, but also in other areas where Albanians were residing in Yugoslavia. The main characteristic of the Kosovo Alternative was that they relied on the idea that by withdrawing consent, they could bring down illegitimate political authority. Especially after the abolition of Kosovo's autonomy, the formal state authorities in Kosovo were considered to be illegitimate, and then the main thing that the Kosovo Alternative tried to do was to call people to use peaceful means in opposing the state institutions. And the other change, which is the more important change, especially for my analysis in my thesis, is the replacement of socialist and Marxist conceptions of political affirmation with concept of democracy and Europeanization. Because of what had happened elsewhere in Europe, the fall of Berlin Wall and the fall of the communist regimes in Europe, gradually all the new political leadership in Kosovo would start using the concept of democracy and Europeanization. So the idea was that the solution of the Albanian issue in Yugoslavia relies on democracy. And this was quite an interesting understanding of democracy because of the fact that Kosovo had its borders, which were quite clearly established within Yugoslavia. So it was a sub-state polity within the larger Yugoslav Federation. The idea was that by the time Kosovo would, or Yugoslavia would become a democratic state, Albanians would, through democratic means, exercise the right to decide about their future. And then they counted on the fact that, because of the fact that Albanians were in clear majority in Kosovo, in any case, they would have the final say when it comes to Kosovo's status. And the other change is that, also when it comes to the underground organizations, national unification was replaced with independence and armed struggle, which was propagated by some of the underground organizations, was replaced with nonviolence. And this is an important moment where the two historically antagonist camps, the institutional one and the underground one, would come very close to each other to form a joint front in opposition to the state measures which were imposed in Kosovo after the abolition of autonomy in 1989. And LDK is the Democratic League of Kosovo, and its leader Rugova became the main political party which would control the so-called Kosovo Alternative. It would give a voice and identity to the Kosovo Alternative, and it was the main party that assumed the mantle of popular legitimacy in Kosovo. But because of the fact that Rugova and LDK entered politics at a time of major ideological changes in Europe, they also appropriated the anti-communist discourse. The paradox was that most of LDK's membership was coming from the dissolved Communist League of Yugoslavia, but still the leadership at the helm, they would appropriate and use the anti-communist and as well as the anti-Yugoslav discourse in their political activity. Even within the Kosovo Alternative, there were divisions and distinctions between different groups and organizations. So initially, the main groups and organizations, including the LDK, they were engaged for a solution within a federal or confederal Yugoslavia. And this was also contingent on other developments in Yugoslavia, debates about the reformation of the Yugoslav state and the idea of creating a joint, a reformed confederal state. And then the other smaller groups, which included some of the underground organizations, which were largely marginalized after 89 as a result of the emergence of LDK and the Kosovo Alternative, but also some other formal political parties would still insist on the idea of unification of all Albanian lands in Yugoslavia and then unification with the state of Albania in a single state. Two important things about the early 90s. The first one is why Albanians chose a peaceful strategy, and the second, why they opted for independence instead of the idea of national unification with the state of Albania. As regards the issue of peaceful strategy, quite a lot has been written about it, and most of the people would argue that the three main reasons why peaceful strategy was chosen was, first, because of the idea, as I mentioned earlier, solving national question through democracy. Second, violence was against the European values, the idea that we want to be part of Europe, and this was featuring quite heavily in Rugova's and LDK's discourse in Kosovo in the early 90s. And the third one was the emancipating character of the Kosovo Alternative. So actually, the Kosovo Alternative played an important role in trying to forge or to project an alternative image about Albanians in Kosovo. So as a result of the 81 protests and then 89 protests, and because of the nationalist mobilization in Yugoslavia in general, but in Kosovo in particular, there was quite a lot of anti-Albanian discourse which was present in the Serbian media in the late 80s. And this part of this image was also portrayed abroad. So the Kosovo Alternative was quite, it thought that it was important for them to portray a different image of Albanians as people who are self-restrained and who choose democracy as opposed to violence. When it comes to the issue of independence and national unification, before explaining that, it's important to spell out that in early 1991, the main political groups and parties in Kosovo, but also in Macedonia, Montenegro, and South Serbia, had several meetings. Some of them were secret, held in Croatia. Some of them were public discussions held in Kosovo. And they came to conclusion that Albanians would have three options when it comes to the political solution of the Albanian question in Yugoslavia. The first one was, in case Yugoslavia remains as a state, as a federation, Albanians would demand equal status within Yugoslavia in the form of a republic. The second one was that in case the internal borders of Yugoslavia were to be redrawn, Albanians would demand that they create their own republic, which would include all Albanians living in the region. And the third option was that in case the external borders of Yugoslavia were to change, Albanians have the right to decide to unite with Albania. So pretty much they would leave open all options on the table. However, because of the way things evolved, the Albanian leadership in Kosovo at that time would gradually move towards the idea of independence. This was partially a choice of theirs, partially conditioned by the political circumstances dominating Yugoslavia at the time, but also there are some other elements that I argue are important. So the first one is that republic had acquired a symbolic meaning in Kosovo and among Albanians as a result of the 81 protests and then what followed later. So achieving republic was seen as a way of achieving national equality within Yugoslavia. The second element is the existence of Kosovo's autonomy between 74 and 81. So here I rely on Philip Roder's segmented institutional thesis. He claims that if you look at the history of the world today, you would see that most of the new states are pre-existing segment states or units embedded within larger states or empire. And he argues that having institutions, pre-existing institutions, it's a big asset for nationalist elites in opting for an independent state rather than another solution, be it unification with another state or to remain part of the existing state or empire. And clearly, the Kosovo autonomous institutions were quite important in creating a new political culture in Kosovo, in empowering political elites who thought that they were capable of running a state. So the idea of the Kosovo alternative was to turn the institutions, the pre-existing institutions of the Kosovo autonomous province, into the institutions of the Republic of Kosovo, which was to be formally declared in 1991. And then the third element is the fall of communism and advent of democracy and EU integration. So the idea was that we won't go for a solution which goes against European values. Violent change of borders was considered to be something that goes against the idea of EU integration and democracy. And the final element is lack of support from Albania. The Albanian communist regime was one of the last ones to crumble, and the new regime, despite of the rhetoric in the early 1990s, was not keen on supporting Kosovo Albanians when it comes to the idea of unification with Albania. So there was no support whatsoever in Albania, like from the major political parties, for unification of Albania with the Albanians living in the neighborhood. What happens later is known as the parallel system. Albanians failed to achieve international recognition, despite of the fact that they applied when the Badinter Commission called on the Yugoslav republics to apply for recognition as independent states. And pretty much they embarked on their own mission to create the parallel institutions. It started with education, then it went on with other institutions as well. But this also enabled LDK to build conceptual hegemony, and also by destroying other political alternatives. And I talk quite a lot in my thesis about the ways LDK was vilifying and also trying to undermine different organizations and groups which opposed its way of doing politics and organizing things. At the same time, we have a split between the two main underground organizations. Actually, the popular movement of Kosovo, LPK, which was an umbrella organization for many underground organizations since the early 1980s, split up between a group which moved to Switzerland and Germany, so they were trying to control underground activities from abroad, and a splinter group, a smaller group, which claimed that they should organize military, first political activities, agitation, and then later military activities from within, so basically in Kosovo. This is an interesting depiction of the main political options that were available in Kosovo in mid-90s, and also it shows how fluid the political stance of the LDK and Rugova was at the time. So it basically, here you can see different options that Rugova would demand at different points in the mid-90s. So from autonomy, because the first thing that LDK demanded when it was created as a political party was the restoration of autonomy. So basically they called for the restoration of autonomy. Then at different points in time, Rugova started talking about a protectorate, Kosovo being an international protectorate as a way of avoiding conflict, but also preparing the country for independence. Then his idea about Kosovo being an open polity between Serbia and Albania. Actually, this is a very, very interesting thing, because if you see what's happening currently with the Brussels agreements and then the border points and then the idea of having softer border between Kosovo and Serbia and then Kosovo and Albania, is quite similar to what Rugova was demanding at that time. And I think it's quite an exception, because for the first time publicly Rugova would also acknowledge the fact that Kosovo was very important in many ways, not only for historical reasons to Serbia, and by being as a buffer zone between Serbia and Albania, that would also diffuse nationalisms of both states and would provide for a solution which would be a good solution, at least for some times. And the idea of Kosovo being as a neutral state, so these were all different options that were on the table and mentioned by Rugova as the main political leader of Albanians in Kosovo in the 1990s. So there were three main camps in the 90s. So it was the semi-legal camp, so LDK and other political parties, which pretended that there is a constitutional democratic order which was existing in Kosovo. They organized elections in 1992. LDK won by an overwhelming majority, and then in a way it legitimized the domination within the Albanian political camp. And also it, through that illegal vote, because it wasn't recognized as legal by Serbia or any other state, it managed to sideline all the other groups and organizations, in first of all underground organizations. However, there was at some point, 1994-95, there was a big rift between Rugova on the one side and the government in exile, which was based in Germany, which was led by Bukoshi at the time. But also there were divisions within LDK as well, because although LDK pretended to be a political party, in a way it was a larger popular front which was representing Albanians and also organizing resistance towards the Serbian state in Kosovo in that period. The other camp was the underground camp comprising the LPK, which was mostly based in diaspora, and LKCK, LKCK, which was a smaller group but which was active within Kosovo. And then gradually there was a third group which was emerging, and I call it the civil society. So this is people who were more open to different political alternatives. The biggest proponent were Beton Suroy and Shkizan Malici. They also opened different political channels with intellectuals and oppositional leaders in Serbia. Often they were supported in different ways by the Soros Foundation, but they were the only ones to engage in public debates with, let's say, the other part, in this case with people and politicians from Serbia. Probably the peak of the political competition in Kosovo is during the Kosovo War, which happened for several reasons. So, despite of the fact that LDK had a clear control over the political organization in Kosovo, by 1996-7, it showed clear signs of exhaustion, and coupled with other factors such as exclusion of Kosovo from Dayton, which was a critical point in development in Kosovo, but also because of the lack of a long-term strategy, when LDK opted for a parallel system, the idea was that that system would be a form of resistance for 1 or 2 years. And then, hopefully, because of the international community's involvement in Yugoslavia, things would go back to normal, and probably Kosovo would first get autonomy and then move on by reactivating the institutions that existed before. As this didn't happen, it became a problem to maintain control in Kosovo and convince people that by showing self-restraint and prudence, international community is going to reward Kosovo Albanians by granting them some sort of autonomy or independence. And the fourth element, which is at some point became the most important element, is internal dissent. It was coming from different directions. So first it was coming from different independent individuals, activists, but also smaller political groups, as well as students who were calling for a more active, non-violent resistance. And actually one of the first symbolic events in Kosovo which would show that LDK was losing control in Kosovo was the student protest organized in October 1997. Rugova, as always, was against any form of provocation because of his convictions that violence doesn't justify any political achievement. So he was a big opponent of any forms of violence, but also provocation that would lead to violence. However, students supported by different oppositional small groups in Kosovo, mostly led by Democi, who at that time entered politics in Kosovo. They organized protests. They were brutally crushed by the Serbian police, but they achieved something very important. They drew international attention to Kosovo. So Kosovo was making headlines again, and this was a warning sign for LDK that there were new actors entering the political arena in Kosovo. So all of a sudden, all the international diplomats who were coming to visit Kosovo, in addition to meeting Rugova and LDK, they would go and meet also the student leaders, which we became quite popular at that time because they had become a political factor in Kosovo. The other struggle that was going on was between LDK and one side was again insisting that eventually the United States is the main supporter of Kosovo and other European countries are going to reward Albanians for their peaceful resistance, and the small armed groups that emerged in Kosovo by 1995-96. So they became known through their actions targeting the Serbian police. But until late 1997, many people were not aware if this were real people or just a phantom army who is staging incidents to provoke Serb retaliation. And the reason why there was this confusion is because LDK used the strategy of denial. If you listen to Rugova's press conferences throughout this period, he would claim that this is something the Serbian security services are doing in order to justify violence in Kosovo. Now it's hard to tell if LDK people had information what was going on, if there were people who were considering armed revolt as a way of solving the political deadlock in Kosovo. But I think it's more a defensive political mechanism that LDK was using because it felt threatened that if this army becomes more popular, then they are going to lose primacy within the Kosovo political camp. However, there was another struggle, a very important one, between KLA and the armed forces of the Republic of Kosovo. By the time KLA became public, and also some of its leaders were known publicly, the Kosovo government in exile decided to create its own parallel army. And the reason behind this was that, again, it was political. The idea that we won't allow some unknown individuals, and there were a lot of rumors as to who is the real leader of the KLA, to control the armed struggle in Kosovo. And this led to divisions within the Kosovo-Albanian camp, and eventually also clashes between the two groups. Ultimately, it would be KLA that would win and dominate the armed resistance, and this was largely due to the fact that they were the first ones to start the uprising, and second, they had a lot of support from the Albanian state. And actually, in this respect, it's quite important what happened in 97. We had Ljubonjan last week talking about the 97 events in Albania. He didn't say anything about the impact in Kosovo, but the 97 events in Albania had a large and huge effect on the developments in Kosovo, not least because of the fact that there was a change in the regime in Albania. Berisha, a long supporter of Rugova and LDK, was ousted from power, and the new socialist government was controlling the government, and they had closer ties with the leadership of KLA. Just briefly explain, like, UÇK's or KLA's elusive political demands. It's interesting that originally KLA was a military wing of the Popular Movement of Kosovo, the underground organization. And the main aim of the underground organization was unification of all Albanian lands in one state. So for quite some time, if you see the press releases of the KLA, clearly they would speak about the idea of national unification. Even KLA's old talks about, so the soldiers would say that as a KLA member, I started to fight for liberation and unification of the occupied lands of Albania. And then later, also in 1998, early 1998, one of the press releases of the KLA would say that KLA comprises the entirety of armed forces of Kosovo and its occupied lands and aims to liberate and unite the occupied lands of Albania. But a major change happens in late 98, and the main reason why this change happened was KLA's need to break the isolation. KLA was quite isolated internationally. Gelbart called it a terrorist organization in March 1998 when he visited Kosovo, and pretty much its leadership was isolated and they had very few contacts with foreign diplomats. So two things happened. First, KLA had to reorganize politically and militarily, and gradually it became independent from the popular movement of Kosovo, who had founded KLA. So it elected a new leadership, people which were younger and which didn't have a lot of experience in underground organization. So by autumn 1998, even formally, they changed the demand to the demand for Kosovo independence. So in one of the memorandums they sent to different international organizations and states, they would say that KLA took up arms to defend the people from the systematic state violence of Milosevic's fascist regime, to enact the will of the people expressed in the 1991 referendum, and to democratize Kosovo. So it's a clear change from the position of uniting with Albania to the position of Kosovo's independence. It's clear that KLA had two main aims. So the first was clearly to achieve independence, but also they thought that dethroning LDK in Rugova was a precondition for liberation from Serbia. So it had also very strong internal competition dimension. And actually many incidents happened during the war. KLA soldiers often would arrest LDK officials. They would hold them for several days and weeks. And also there were clashes between the armed forces of the Republic of Kosovo and KLA in summer and autumn 1998. So paradoxically, Kosovo's international intervention would come at a time when Kosovo's political spectrum was highly fragmented. So it didn't happen in 1991 when there was a lot of political consent in Kosovo, and then there was a larger popular front which was organized in order to resist the Serbian oppressive measures in Kosovo. But it happened at a time where the political camp in Kosovo was highly fragmented in 1998-1999. And as Kopjanas put it, so it happened when Kosovo had two self-declared prime ministers. After Rambouillet, KLA formed its own government. So it had two self-prime ministers of a self-declared country, half of whose population was living in refugee camps outside its borders. So this was the moment when the international community intervened in Kosovo. And that intervention would have major consequences for the Albanian nationalism in general, and also for the Serb-Albanian relations in Kosovo, but also in the region at large. And finally, the last period, it's the period under UN administration. I'm just briefly mentioning the main changes we had. So there were two main struggles. The first one was between the different Albanian parties and groups and the UN administration in Kosovo. This was a struggle for political control. Who is going to control Kosovo? Immediately after the entrance of NATO troops in Kosovo, the KLA soldiers would take over all the municipalities and they would start organizing their own parallel administration in Kosovo. Bukush's government comes back in Kosovo again, so there are two governments which pretend to be the legitimate rulers in Kosovo. And then we have the third contender, which is the United Nations, and the only one which was legally supposed to be in charge of the organization of administration in Kosovo. And the second struggle is between the different groups and parties in Kosovo. So the main cleavage was between the pacifists, the LDK and other groups which were at the helm of the political organization in the 90s, and the parties that had emerged from the dissolved KLA. However, it's important to mention that although KLA was formally demilitarized and transformed into political parties and war associations, also there was an effect on the other countries, namely South Serbia and Macedonia. And these revolts that happened there actually are closely related to the power struggles within the KLA. because of the way things happened in the power contest within KLA, some people were marginalized in 1999, and then they thought that the way to do things was to split up from the political leadership, which now was concentrating on Kosovo, and pursue military activities elsewhere. And the main justification was that KLA's original goal was national unification, and the present or the political leadership of KLA in 1999 had betrayed that goal, and they were pursuing that that goal. And the final slide, just one. So, when it comes to UN, it's important to say that formally most of the parties would cooperate with UNMIC in building new institutions in Kosovo, but on the other hand, especially the parties that emerged from the KLA, they would boycott and also undermine UN efforts. Especially they would apply policy resistance when it came to UN's engagement in creating a, as they call it, a multi-ethnic society, and also probably opening channels of communication with the new regime that emerged in Serbia after the democratic changes in 2000. So the other important thing is that despite being sidelined by UÇK or KLA in 1998-1999, democratic elections enabled LDK to reclaim political supremacy in Kosovo. It was a huge surprise when LDK won the first elections in Kosovo by an overwhelming majority, although many people had considered that it was politically dead, especially after Rugova's meeting with Milosevic during the NATO bombardment campaign. So I'll stop here, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions there. It was quite a tour de force of over many decades. Anyone like to open the bidding? Gentleman there, if you could perhaps identify yourself.
This is for my colleague, so I won't ask too many questions about the subject, but more conceptual things. My name is Dejan Stipakovic, I'm postdoctoral fellow at University College of Dublin. One is the secessionist merger. You talk about the kind of concept about the secessionist merger type of political movement, and how is this different from the dentist movement? So if you can just explain this. And then the other question, just a short question, is about the self-determination movement, the Veterinär-Ossier, and these struggles continue after the 2008. Maybe if you could just elaborate.
Well, and when it comes to secessionist merger, I think it's just another term to describe irredentism as a form of political activism. So I don't think there is any substantial difference between the two, but different authors use different terms, and I thought this was more appropriate terms for the analysis I was doing. As regards the second question, this is one thing I forgot to mention. I don't agree with the self-determination movement a lot, because my analysis stops in 2008. Before 2008, that Vendosia was a very weird political formation in many senses. First, the original group of people was organized under the Kosovo Action Network, which was an umbrella of civil society organizations, and actually, strangely enough, they did a lot of activities with different NGOs and organizations in Serbia, and its main objective was to engage people politically under the UN administration. The idea was that the UN administration in Kosovo was undemocratic because it lacked any democratic legitimacy. It was imposed from above. And then even when it changed its name into self-determination, they engaged for Kosovo's independence through a referendum. So this is what some Russian diplomats have been saying recently. When they were drawing differences between Kosovo and Crimea, they said there has never been a referendum in Kosovo, so Kosovo's independence is not legal. So what self-determination engaged for was independence, but also they were the only one to formally oppose the Ahtisaari plan, and they became quite public, but they were very small in terms of membership and also the power they were holding with the Kosovo. They became more political only after independence, and only after independence they came up with the idea of national unification. So what we have now, it's almost like a full circle. So that Vendosi is going back to the origins of Albanian nationalism. Actually, they try to represent that lineage of groups and organizations which historically engaged for national unification. So now this is their understanding of nationalism and the current political affairs. But now, in many ways, they are a state subverting organization. Although they have become part of the Kosovo political system, they oppose its symbols. They often do actions like taking down the flag from institutions and streets. And even now, like in the municipality of Pristina, where they rule, that's the only municipality where they rule, so they don't use state symbols in their meetings, which is a very paradoxal thing. So you are elected within that legal framework, but then you oppose the state in the name of the nation and the idea of national unification. And as such, is the main group, actually, that is nation-centric in Kosovo. All the other major political parties that emerged after 1999, they are state-centric, so they engage for Kosovo's independence and then also gaining international legitimacy in the form of UN membership.
Timo.
Dimitar Becerlis, you mentioned in passing how the division inside the Kosovo movement mapped onto all what's related to divisions inside Albania's domestic politics. And it would be really helpful if you could share with us a few more thoughts about this transnational or trans-border linkages. Because apart from Albania, you also have the contestation in Macedonia. So how the intra-group competition impacts the Macedonian political system, where actually we have various parties affiliated to support this or that party in Kosovo. And maybe other places as well, Montenegro comes to mind. So what is the spillover effect on and the linkage effect on political arenas next door to Kosovo? And secondly, this Kosovo first territorial, I mean, out of curiosity, how was there any point where actually the question of using the Kosovo dialect sprang up, as opposed to standard Albanian, as a token of nativism or Kosovo being something distinctive?
Yeah, thank you very much. So, as I said, there have been two main periods of intra-group struggles which spread throughout the Albanian inhabited territories or regions, whatever. So the first was about the interwar period. The Kosovars were defeated in the struggle for domination in Albania as a result of King's Zog rule in Albania. The second one was the Second World War. First, they won the battle because one of the Kosovo leaders became the prime minister of the independent, neutral, enlarged Albanian states under German tutelage between 43 and 44. And then, again, they were defeated. But what's important is that although LDK had very close ties with Berisha, they had embarked on a separate political project, and actually they were even playing the idea of creating a separate political identity in Kosovo. I think it's quite strange that Rugova didn't propose Kosovo symbols in the early 90s. Had he done that, things would have been slightly different because he was so popular in Kosovo. So, like, Kosovo was using the Albanian flag even in the 90s. For example, I finished the elementary school in the parallel system of education, and if you see my diploma, it says Republic of Kosovo, Ministry of Education, and then you have an Albanian flag. That's it. There was no coat of arms formally, so that the Kosovo leadership would use the Albanian flag. But gradually, they started talking about a separate Kosovo political identity, not national identity. When it comes to connections between LDK and other parties, until 1993-94, actually LDK was the main political party of Albanians in the region. It controlled all the other parties. So if you see the first Albanian party in Macedonia. It was in many ways a branch of LDK, and its political demands were put forward in close cooperation with LDK. However, there is a rupture in 1994 when Berisha intervenes in Macedonia, so he supports one of the groups of people, Arben Jaferi and Mendel Faccio, the current leader of the Democratic Party in Macedonia, and there happens a split between the two parties. What happens with the NLA in Macedonia actually is people from the underground organizations who were defeated in the struggle for control of KLA in 1999, Alia Metin, also Fazlivi Niu, these were the two people who were among the key leaders of the popular movement of Kosovo until 1998. But then there is a switch in political leadership when, because of the support coming from the Albanian government in Tirana, a new leadership of KLA emerged with Faci as its leader. He was very young at that time, 29, 30. He was largely unknown. So it's quite a big mystery how he managed to establish himself as the main leader of KLA and push aside all the other older cadres. So when the uprising happened in Macedonia, it was a way of becoming important or remaining relevant in politics for these people who were sidelined in the political battle in Kosovo. But I think now we have a completely different situation where Macedonia has emerged as a separate political center of Albanians. The new part, the main party in Macedonia is largely independent. It's not controlled anymore by Pristina or by Tirana. It's quite powerful, actually, because they've been in government almost since 2001. They control a lot of resources in Macedonia. And even in the last elections, they had a record number of votes among Albanians in Macedonia. So in a way, it's a separate center. There is one thing I'll be working now at UCL. So I'm working on a rather new concept of national polycentrism or multi-state nations, the way Albanians pretty much function today in the region, where you have this sense of shared ethnicity, but then you have separate political centers which are quite independent from each other. The second question about the dialogue, there has, at least formally, there hasn't been any initiative. There have been some private individual initiatives by some journalists and publicists, but LDK and Rugova, they've never played with the idea of creating a separate dialogue, so they would never put in question the idea of having one standard dialogue. But then after the war in Kosovo, there have been some voices, quite isolated, which claim that because now Kosovo is a new state, it would make more sense to have a new standardized language, which is based on the northern dialect, which is the predominant dialect in Kosovo.
Lida.
According to your opinion, do you think that the mainstream Albanian nationalist agenda has been accomplished, thus completed with the independence of Kosovo, or there's still more to go until there's these sentiments about greater Albania, and something that we saw pretty much alive, not only within Kosovo, but also Albania, and among intellectuals also in Albania during this past week, what happened with Belgrade and Serbia. So do you think there's still more to go, or it has been already accomplished with the independence of Kosovo? There's no more these imperialist aspirations for a greater state?
Well, no, first of all, no nationalism considers itself to be imperialist, so it's in the nature of nationalism. I think you can never satisfy nationalism. And if you look back at the history of the Balkans, even at the times where states would control large parts of territory, again, there would be something that would be missing there. So a geostrategic territory, a port, a sea, some historical objects or something. So this is a problem inherent in nationalism. I think the main problem today for the Albanian societies in the region is that you have a rather young population which is facing a lot of economic and social problems. So there is a growing discontent with the current states they live in, starting from Albania. So the fact that 1 million people left Albania in 1991 shows how desperate people were to have a better life and to have better chances in life. Now, some of these people who live in Italy and stuff, they might show nationalist sentiment, but this is one of the paradoxes of nationalism. So how you're deeply unhappy with your own state. And Albania is one of the exceptions in the region in terms of being quite homogeneous as a nation state. So it, especially compared to the former Yugoslavia. So this is probably the main source of discontent. And then it's another thing how that is channeled. And I think always nationalism and symbolic expression of nationalism is one of the ways of dealing with this discontent that exists there. But as we could see from the last week's incident, you could see that unfortunately very quickly you can mobilize people based on nationalism. So someone, I think Ljubonia was saying last week, how you have like widespread corruption everywhere in the region, including Kosovo and Albania, and you don't get five people to protest about things. But then when it comes to the spontaneous expressions of nationalist sentiments, then you can see a huge wave of people expressing nationalist sentiments. Formally, politically, there is none of the elites are publicly and formally committed to such idea. Now there are a lot of conspiracy theories, if you read in the regional media about the intentions of Albania or something. It's a fact that Kosovo and Albania are moving very close to each other. I think part of the reason is because of the Serbia's position towards Kosovo. It's because of Serbia that Kosovo now perceives the national Albanian football team as its own team. So the national football team has emerged as the first pan-Albanian institution in the region. And I think this is very important from the symbolic perspective to analyze why people rally behind the national team. I think we're Kosovo allowed to be part of UEFA since 2000, let's say, probably people would have got used to a Kosovo national team, which clearly would have been better than the Albanian national team, because today the best players of the Albanian national team are from Kosovo. So these are very interesting political dynamics in the region. And I think one thing is the official discourse, the political discourse, which is we will preserve the borders we have now, but there is nothing that prevents us from cooperating closer within the larger process of European integration. This seems to be the commitment of the main elites, but again, you have parties like Self-Determination, which engages for unification with Albania, but then they don't answer the question, how do you convince Albania to unite with you, when you don't have a big party in Albania which is in favor of unification. In the last election, for the first time, there was one party which ran the nationalist platform. They failed to enter the parliament, the Red and Black Alliance in Albania, and that shows a lot about the way people understand nationalism, especially in the state of Albania.
Got Julia.
Thank you. My name is Julia Hemrich. I'm a PhD student here at the LSE. Thank you very much, and congratulations for a really good presentation at PhD, of course. My question is, the first one, well, it's two related questions. The first one is about the control over the diaspora that you mentioned, because you said that was very important for the KLA to then gain more power. And related to that is because you mainly spoke about, obviously, about the internal struggles, but are there maybe key aspects of external effects on these internal struggles that you identified during your research?
Thank you very much. So when it comes to diaspora, especially in the 90s, it emerged as an important, very important audience for the political struggles in Kosovo for a very simple reason, because 500,000 people were forced to migrate because they were expelled from their jobs. And then they were the only ones that were controlling important financial resources. So they played a key role in helping people survive in Kosovo, but also they were the only ones who would actually the main audience who would fill the if you could say the bags of the Kosovo government in exile. And this money was very important to organize the parallel segments of life in Kosovo, the education system. So this was done with the money. Once the conflict started, people became more emotional, as it always happens, because of the images of refugees and then civilian victims and everything. And this was a good opportunity for the two main camps, actually, to control the diaspora. And actually, there was a fierce battle, and people were if you talk to so many people from diaspora today, they feel completely betrayed because they were so emotional, and often they would pay into different funds. So one was the LDK fund, which was known as the 3% fund. It was controlled by the government, so people were supposed to give from 3 to 5% of their income in Germany, and they would use this money to pay for the activities of LDK in Kosovo, but also for the education system. And then once the war started, the popular movement created its own fund, which was Homeland Calling, a very interesting sounding name. And actually they managed, no one knows how much money was collected in diaspora at this time by both camps. And today often you hear accusations when they need for political purposes that a certain person used to steal millions from this fund or something. But it was crucial for the two camps to control diaspora, because the more money you had, the more chances you had to dominate the armed struggle, but also in the case of the KLA, to have a more access to weapons which it needed to wage a war against Serbia. Sorry, what was the second question?
External factors that influence the struggle.
I think there's a clear correlation between the external and the internal factors. What is important is that, as I said, you could see that international legitimacy is a key component in the struggle between many groups. And this has other consequences, such as moderation in demands. And then I explained in the case of KLA how, because of its need to be accepted internationally, they had to drop the idea of national unification and just say that we are fighting Milosevic because he represents a fascist regime, and then we want to achieve Kosovo's independence, which was the same demand that the LDK was putting forward.
That's your hand up. No.
Thank you. I'm Bao. I'm a PhD student at SOAS. So can we go back to the 90s just a little bit? You were speaking about Rugova's strategy of peaceful protest, and you stated one of the reasons was because his belief that Europe has a value of non-violence. I mean, where I study, they probably say the opposite. It's all about violence, and maybe what happened in Serbia and Bosnia sort of proof that Europe does reward violence. So was this a rhetorical strategy from Rugova, or did he sincerely believe it? And if so, can we say that he was perhaps naive in his belief that he could actually reason with Milosevic, or that Europe would actually support his Gandhi-like struggle?
Well, I think it was both. So first, like, they believed that was, especially Rugova, he believed that that's the way things work, and then that's the strategy Albanians should pursue, and then they would be rewarded by the government. The case of Kosovo shows that actually violence is rewarded in the sense that you draw international attention only when you become a problem. So Rugova had been a victim of its own success, because he managed to control people and population for a rather long period of time. But by controlling them, he was not important anymore in the political developments, because Croatia had priority because of the conflict, then Bosnia because of the war that was going on. And what you end up with at the end is complete isolation, in the sense that no one is interested about you anymore. So I think what the case of Kosovo shows paradoxal is that, like, Rugova was wrong to believe, but now I think it's hard to understand. I think his political understanding was quite limited, so he was more like a semi-mythical figure in Kosovo, because if you see some of the speeches he gave, for example, it's very dry. There is not a lot of political creativity, so he had no clear vision. He was quite stubborn in the sense that there is a refusal to talk with Serbs without international participation or mediation. We won't give up independence and no violence. These were the three things he would say all the time, but beyond that there was nothing. There were other people, academicians, scholars, who would be more creative in terms of proposing different solutions, especially in the early 90s. But by the time he became the dominant political figure, it was very difficult to challenge his political supremacy in Kosovo, even if you had very creative ideas. And the matter of the fact is that many people had quite interesting ideas, ranging from the idea of participating in the Serbian election together with the democratic opposition in Serbia. This was supported by Demotsi at some point, Suroi and Malisi, and even Berisha in 96, he was calling on the Kosovo Albanian to support the opposition in Serbia, but Rugova was quite stubborn in refusing any cooperation with the Serbian opposition.
Got one final question. Quite short.
My name is Nijas Dnjak. I'm coming from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I'm doing a master's in foreign policy here in City University. I would like to ask you about the level of informal and, let's say, unofficial relation between Albania and Kosovo. So the information that I get from my friends, Albanian friends, are in a way that there is no formal border, actually, and that the travel and any other kind of relation is totally free. So how that influence the general political, economical, or even social status of both states in general? How that influence those three?
Well,
and is it present as is it the fact?
There is a border there. The only thing is that it's an integrated border, so you have only one border point there. What happens is that during the summer season, often there are no controls, but then you have the Kosovo police patrolling some of the roads within Albania to make sure that they will help people, mostly Kosovo tourists who are there. So I think it's not that different from the border, let's say, between Macedonia and Serbia, where you can just show the ID card and cross on the other side. So it's that kind of cooperation. But I think clearly there is you have a sense that you're crossing a border. And I think this is how the border between Serbia and Kosovo is going to be once the situation is normalized. It's precisely the same idea, the integrated border management system, where you would show your ID card only at one point. So you have one border post, which is where you have representatives of the two states, the custom officials and the border police.
Okay. Well, before I say thank you, just wanted to give you a heads up of a couple of other events that we have coming up. I'm sure many of you are aware that on Monday we have Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić coming to speak. Unfortunately, all the tickets are now gone, but if anyone does want to attend, we will have a returns queue on the evening. So you can chance it and see if you want to come along and hear what he's got to say. I think it's certainly an interesting time to be listening to him. And then 2 weeks today, our next visiting speaker is Professor Mikhail Arandarenko, who is a visiting fellow here at LISI, here in the audience this evening, and he will be speaking on the political economy of unemployment in the Western Balkans. So for the economists amongst you, it's I often get accused of not including enough economists, and this is certainly hopefully will more than make up for that shortcoming. In the meantime, let me thank Gezin very, very much for coming along and giving such an interesting talk to us all. And please join me in thanking him again.